great conference. And please interrupt me anytime you wish. I'm going to talk about some recent and some not so recent work. I'm going to focus on two basic models of non-Fermi liquids, which are in some sense solvable. Try to compare and contrast their properties. And then if I have time in the last part of my talk, I will tell you about some thoughts about recent experiments on the high temperature superconductors. Okay, so let me begin by just defining for the purpose of this talk what I mean by a non-Fermi liquid. So basically, first of all, one thing I would like to have, because it's found in many experiments, is what's called a compressible phase. So a compressible phase is something where the density of electrons usually can be varied smoothly by tuning a parameter. Now, this is no problem at finite temperature. You can always change the density by tuning anything. But at zero temperature, this is a bit delicate. There are only actually a few phases in which you can vary density continuously, one of which is, of course, the Fermi liquid, which is adiabatically connected to free electrons. And the other is a superfluid. Now, we don't want either of these. We want some other phases that are compressible, where the density can be varied. So we want the global U1 symmetry to be unbroken to avoid the superfluid. Then the second criterion is that there be the excitations cannot be described as quasiparticles. So of course, in a Fermi liquid, you have electronic quasiparticles, but in other exotic states, you could have spinons, holons, bisons, Laughlin quasiparticles, what you wish. You don't want any of those. Yes?
Isn't the solid also compressible at zero temperature?
Sure, thank you. But that's, it's compressible, but then again, there's a broken symmetry that is associated with the compressibility. Yeah, I forgot to mention that. Good point. So we don't want broken translational symmetry either. Continuous broken translational symmetry. Okay, so we don't want any quasi-particle excitations. So now, one way we think about quasi-particles is, you know, you kick a system and you see something moving for a long time in a straight line. Then you have a quasi-particle. But another way to formulate it, which has turned out to be very fruitful, is to think of the existence of quasi-particles as sort of almost integrability. It means that if you kick the system, you create a bunch of quasi-particles. They move for a long time independent of each other. And eventually, they collide with each other. And once they collide, the system becomes chaotic and thermalizes. But it takes some long time for quasi-particles to find each other and thermalize. So you know, existence of quasi-particles is sort of like quasi-integrability or long times to reach equilibrium. So then we can say, and without quasi-particles, a positive way of saying that is that you reach equilibrium as fast as possible. So if you look at simple models, which is what I did way back when, the fastest rate turns out to be just this basic rate, h bar over kt, times a constant. So we can take this as sort of a more positive definition of a system, which C is not very well defined at this point. It depends precisely on exactly what you know. And there's certainly no theorems on the rates with these definitions. Of course, one beautiful improvement in recent work has been this Lyapunov time, defined by Maldacena, Schenker, and Stanford, by some complicated four-point correlation function, which is basically impossible to measure in kinesmat experiments. But the virtue of that function is that it allows you to prove a bound on a time that's very much linked to that function and the transition to chaos or thermalization. Okay, so, and it's worth noting, so here, of course, we have a rigorous statement. With other definitions, it's worth noting that you know, there are no exceptions that have been found ever. So you could have had, you know, square root of t in something. You took some system, you solved it, and somebody found a square root of t. Well, then I'd be very worried. This is all as t goes to zero. But that's never, yes?
Don't you think there's a lot of room in between separating these bounds and having quasi particles?
There are certain systems which we think of having quasi-particles, but this is just logarithmically larger. So that's getting, you know, then there's not much room at that point. Certainly, in a Fermi liquid, it's 1 over t squared, and you could say there's a lot of room between 1 over t squared and 1 over t. Oh, maybe, okay. Is that what you mean?
In particular, the chaos stuff.
I mean, sorry, I don't quite understand what.
I'm trying to think that they're not in the liquid who don't saturate the chaos bound.
Oh, sure, sure, but I suspect they all have parametrically 1 over temperature. maybe the 1 over 2 pi will be different. So certainly I would think that, in fact, the models I'm going to talk about today, we don't know for sure, but that would be my guess. Certainly for conformal field theories, you take the Wilson-Fisher conformal field theory, which strictly speaking doesn't is not a type 1, but anyway, it still has no quasi-particle excitations. I don't expect the number to be 1 over 2 pi for that, but some other number.
Also, the second line is not true, right?
Sure, again, but that's the 4 pi that gets violated, not anything else. So you're going to get other.
We don't know that, right?
Yeah, okay.
It could be zero.
Right, so so these two bonds which have to do with transport coefficients, which you can relate to bounds on time, but they have the virtue of being measurable much more easily. And yeah, so there, as you said, there's no rigorous proof of this at this point, unlike this one. Yeah. Here, an interesting feature is that if you have a system with momentum conservation, as Andy discussed yesterday, then this bond is easily satisfied. It's much larger, the diffusivity. But if you had something, a fixed bond with disorder and interactions, of which have only precious few examples, then you would expect this kind of bound that I guess Mike discussed day before yesterday or yesterday. Okay, that's what a non-Fermi liquid is. I think this is a fairly satisfactory definition for my purposes. Okay, of course, yes.
So, probability of probability might be worrying some of these quantities, for example, delta over S or things like that, are a bit too sensitive. They're more complicated quantities than we thought they would be.
Yeah.
There might be some other quantities that are more horizontal,
right.
Might be more universal.
I agree with you. I think this time seems to be the most robust
right.
of that type. When you go from times to transport coefficient, then there are all kinds of issues that can arise. Depending on anisotropy in space or extra conservation laws, and then it's uncertain. We'll see in this bond actually in my favorite non-Fermi liquid, or second favorite I should say, is badly. It's much larger. So I mean it's never violated, but it's much larger. In all of these cases, also I think even here, I mean the bond is okay, but it can be much much larger in a non-Fermi liquid. Yeah.
So maybe that depends on a personal definition. But normally, when we say non-Fermi liquid, we normally imply that somehow Fermi Dirac statistics should be important in the.
No.
I believe it's a Boser.
Yeah. So if you have a better name, I'd love to use it. That's how we call it, a strange metal. Yeah, I agree. There's no the Fermi statistics. I think the easiest way we know of getting. Non-Fermi liquid is to start with a system of fermions and put a lot of interactions. Now, in principle, you could start with a system of bosons and get what people call a Bose metal in some cases, and that would be a non-Fermi liquid too. Since there are no quasi-particles, there's no question of Fermi-Dirac statistics. I don't know. I think the name is completely random, and it's like many other things in condensed matter, where things are defined by what they're not.
Yeah.
So it's a non, both Fermi and liquid, you know.
So I would say it's just historical because when the heavy fermions came along, the Fermi liquid was thought to be sacred for a couple of years because
right.
it was so huge. Usually we normalize.
Yes,
so
you're right.
Metal was a Fermi liquid, and then the cuprates came along, and just when everybody had decided that, there came this new class of material.
Okay, yeah, thank you. I was also alive in those days. My memory is not good. So this is Andy's famous plot, I guess, probably has been shown earlier in this meeting. So it's very suggestive that in many materials, if you try to estimate the time, it's basically order kT over h bar. And since this is a measurement from from conductivity, you know, for this to work, you really need a theory where disorder is important. That's something that Sean has emphasized, what he calls an incoherent metal. Only then would you have, you know, get times of disorder from a transport measurement. Okay, so I'm going to talk about these two almost solvable models that have their own virtues. This one has lots of disorder, but in the end, it just averages away, which is great. And this one has no disorder, and so conductivity is a bit subtle. And Andy discussed related issues yesterday in his talk, so I'll mostly skip the discussion of conductivity. And hopefully, I'll have some time to say something about the cuprates in the end. Okay, so let's talk about the SYK model. But it's useful to begin with a model of a Fermi liquid first. And here we're going to take a model of Fermi liquid with lots of disorder. So there's no Fermi surface at all, but the idea of quasiparticles is still present. And you can still distinguish, as I'll show you, a Fermi liquid from a non-Fermi liquid. So this is just the famous random matrix model. You have fermions hopping with some random matrix element Tij, which has zero average. So this is very easy to solve. You just diagonalize the random matrix, and you occupy the lowest Qn eigenstates. Now, there's a very famous semicircular density of states of a random matrix. And so if you look at the imaginary part of the Green's function, then these are the occupied states, and these are the empty states. And the important feature is that right at the Fermi level, there's a finite density of states. And as I'll show you in a minute, that's really the reason why this behaves like a Fermi liquid. Operationally, the way you solve this problem is just by doing Feynman diagrams. You just expand in T. You just expand in Tij. Just write down all the graphs. There's only just a very simple set of graphs. This is your Green's function, and this is your disorder. And it, you know, this is the undergraduate quantum mechanics problem of a fermion moving in a potential. So this is just an the Lippmann-Schwinger expansion in the powers of the potential. And now all you have to do is average over T. And the average over T means that since this here we're assuming is Gaussian for simplicity, that these things will get linked to each other like that. And so this then becomes your self-energy. This is sigma. And you can see sigma is just T squared times G, where this is the G right here. So that's this equation right here. And now you just solve these two equations. It's a quadratic equation, and you get the easiest way of getting the famous semicircular law. There's also ways using supersymmetry and God knows what else, but this is much simpler. Of course, those other methods give you much more information, including the famous Wigner-Dyson statistics of eigenvalue spacings and so on. All right, so now why is this a Fermi liquid? Well, let's put in some interactions. And I've just taken some random interactions here, but it's more general than that. And let's ask the same question. Quickly does the system equilibrate? So we imagine we are in some low temperature thermal state with some Fermi-Dirac distribution about this chemical potential of quasiparticles of occupied states. And then you perturb it a little bit and you ask, how long does it take to thermalize? Well, for it to thermalize, you can estimate that just using Fermi's golden rule. So you have a quasiparticle sitting in some state alpha with energy E alpha, and it's going to scatter off some other state sitting in energy E beta, state beta into states gamma and delta. So state beta must be occupied, states gamma and delta must be empty, energy must be conserved, and you just average over everything else, and there you get T squared. So this is the simplest way to derive this T squared law. And it just comes from the integral over these Fermi functions. Okay, so it takes a long time. It takes a long time of order T squared, which is why we call this a Fermi liquid. Okay, so now the SYK model is basically the same model, except you send Tij equal to zero. So you have only interactions, yes?
In itself, it could be
linear
ways to get a T squared, right?
Sure.
So, but there are other tests that we do have quasiparticles in this model?
I don't know. I mean, they all come down to the scattering rate in the end. You could, I mean, it would be nice to actually compute this this 4-point out of time autocorrelation function. I don't know if anybody's done it, but I mentioned it to one of my students, but I didn't hear back on it. So maybe it wasn't very interesting. I don't know. Yeah, there could be. It could be other things. I think certainly it would be nice to, I think, compute the out of time autocorrelation function. I suspect it'll come out to be t squared too.
But yeah. You do have that propagated, or not? You do have g. So can you just check the width versus the...
Sure, you could do that too. But but it's important to then at that point, so this is imaginary right here. So you can't look at the average Green's function. You have to look at the G in a quasi, in the exact eigenstate. You have to look at G alpha alpha, not G ij averaged. This one has a huge lifetime. So if you just looked at the imaginary part of G, then you would say there's no quasi particles. But, you know, so this is also true in finite dimension in theory of disordered metals. I mean, there's a famous paper by Abrahams, Ramakrishnan et al., where they showed that when you have a diffusive metal, so even though the elastic scattering time is very short, so the momentum eigenstates are very, you know, don't last very long at all, almost order as quickly as the Fermi energy, there's still a quasi-particle lifetime, which is very long, and a three-dimensional diffusive metal that goes as t to the 3/2, not t squared. So that's behind all this Altshuler-Aronoff theory of disorder interactions in a weakly diffusive metal. This is some extreme limit of that. Okay. So this, then I was just starting to describe the SYK model. So this is a model with disorder and interactions. And in the way we originally worked on it, in the 90s, with Jin Wu Ye and Olivier Parcollet and Antoine George, we had a slightly different form in which we had to take a double scaling limit to get rid of the effects of disorder. If you took any other limit, it seemed like the system would freeze into a spin glass, and the spin glass, you know, is a state that is exquisitely sensitive to everything, to all the disorder. Now, in this new formulation proposed by Kateyev, it turns out we don't have to worry about the spin glass phase at all, which is great. And everything, the disorder self-averages beautifully, and this is amply confirmed by numerical studies, because this is now much easier to study numerically than the old formulation. So, but the state we get in this new formulation is the same as the state, and all its basic properties are essentially the same that we had found, although it was much harder to work with the old formulation, at least numerically. And also, this now has a very natural interpretation as just a non-Fermi liquid. So you have basically two-body interactions between any quartet of sites. You just pick any four sites, and there's a random number with zero average, which determines the strength of that interaction. And that's it. Now there's, you know, I've written in terms of complex fields, but you can also write Majorana, and you can add other global symmetries of, but they all have basically the same properties. All right, so how do you solve this? Well, you can try to solve this in exactly the same way by just doing weak disorder perturbation theory. And now you have some interaction. Here, so here's some JIJKL, and there's one electron coming and one going out, another going out, and another coming in. Okay, so that's what one interaction looks like. And then there's another interaction here with, again, two electrons going in and two coming out. And then there's here some JI prime, J prime, K prime, L prime. And now you just do the average, and it turns out that everything is subdominant. There's only one term that dominates the average, and that's the term where you link with this and put I equals I prime and J equals J prime. All four have to be equal, and that just gets replaced by G squared. So when you do that, now you can also close these, and that's your graph. So the final equations are very similar to the random matrix model, except sigma is g squared times g. And this is the graph here for the self energy. Okay, so there's a bit more analysis involved to show that this none of the other graphs matter, but that's basically the argument. So now you just have to solve these three equations. That's easier said than done because we still haven't figured out. I think in the latest paper of Martensen and Stanford, we are finally now understanding the full structure of these equations. That's it. It's just an applied math problem of solving these three equations, and it's amazingly challenging and rich. And these equations know about black holes and Hawking entropy and so on, which is kind of quite remarkable. Certainly something we never dreamed of in 93. Okay. So the one thing is easy to get, which we already got, is a leading singularity. Of the Green's function. So the leading singular, first of all, if you look at these equations, the first thing took a while for me to realize is that the solution has to be gapless, and in fact is a compressible non-Fermi liquid state. And the reason is follows. Suppose there was a gap. Then from this equation, the gap, meaning the imaginary part, is zero for some range of omega. Imagine the gap in sigma is must equal the gap in G. Okay, fine. But from this equation, if you now just write this in the Lehmann spectral form, you can see that the gap in sigma is thrice the gap in G. So the only solution is there's no gap. So if you want a solution at finite density, then it must be a gapless solution. But we did find the solution, and for I think almost 6 months didn't even want to publish it because I was worried the solution meant nothing. The actual solution was a spin glass. And to get the spin glass solution, you can't just do this. You have to put all the replica indices and look at the replica off-diagonal terms and so on, which we spent a lot of time on, several years, and I'm fortunately not showing any of that. But anyway, and in fact, it's also, you know, if you did the same kind of trickery to the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model, which curiously is also SK model, that model, if you did this kind of stuff for the Ising model with random exchange, you'll get completely the wrong answer. And Parisi eventually figured out the right solution. But here, fortunately, if you just do the naive thing, you get the right answer. And now we know from numerical studies that indeed, no question, it's the right answer because the numerics agree so well, by off exact diagonalization, agree so well with the solution of these equations.
So if you change your original Lagrangian, the fermions to bosons.
Yes, I'll show you the results for that in a minute. So now you can, as I said, that you can get the leading singularity, and the leading singularity turns out to be 1 over square root of omega. So you assume some power law, and again, just a few lines of consistency tells you. So I just mentioned a few minutes ago, we don't know everything about this theory. Now you can add, what's the subleading singularity? What are the next set of operators? So what is the next term here? And I spent several months and several notebooks full of calculations trying to find the next term, and I couldn't find any solution. And that's what had me worried, is this thing right? Because I couldn't even figure out what the next term was. But eventually, we just published anyway, luckily. and now, from this analysis of Martensen and Stanford, I think we have a way, and using all this conformal trickery, to get the next term. All right, so to address Hong's question, so this is the numerical study by Wenbo Fu, and there have been several by other people too, and Wenbo is not here. He was here last week. So I won't try to explain the details of this graph, but the short answer is what we are comparing is exact diagonalization on some 20 sites and then taking many realizations. Of course, if you just had in large enough sites, you only need to have one realization. You don't need to average, it self-averages. Where we do some averaging here because our systems are small. And the full result, okay, there are some deviations at very low frequency is basically consistent with this. And then to answer Hong's question, so we tried to do the same thing, exact diagonalization with hardcore bosons. And then we found these large peaks at zero frequency, which look nothing like this 1 over square root of z solution from the numerical diagonalization. And that very strong indication that, in fact, for boson, this thing becomes a spin glass. And the reason really is simply that, you know, if you want to optimize these j's and lower your energy by freezing something, you want to freeze all four indices. So you take most advantage of a particular Jijkl. So you have to condense all four operators. And with bosons, you can do that, but fermions, you can't. So Fermi statistics is really crucial to finding a stable non-Fermi liquid ground state here, at least at the UV. So then, there are, as I mentioned, other studies. And so now, you know, we can confidently say that we finally have a Hamiltonian for which the actual ground state is a non-Fermi liquid. So, which is a nice thing to be able to say, finally. Yeah?
Does it continue to be the opposite Hamiltonian particle non-constraining?
Yes, so that's the Majorana case that Alexei Kitaev has looked at, where there's no global U1 symmetry. It is important, however, to have a zero average of the couplings. So if you like put in pairing terms, I don't know. We haven't studied the most general case where you have both pairing terms and non-pairing terms. There's probably some condition on zero average that will be required to get this type of solution. I mean, otherwise you might get just some superconductor which is totally frozen or something like that. Yeah.
And if average is on zero, the gap opens up, do you get
sleep? None of that's been studied. Yeah. I mean, we try to think about them at least in the old days, and there wasn't much motivation, but it seemed like you get some sort of order if you had a non-zero average. You do want to see that? Okay. So what's been plotted here is the square root of omega times imaginary part of g. So this blue line is the exact solution. The fact that it goes to a constant here tells you have a square root of omega singularity. That's the solution of the integral equation. You solve this equation numerically, you get the blue line. The other lines are with increasing system size, the same quantity for exact diagonalization. You know, and it's slowly approaching the blue line.
So you're saying as you make the system size larger,
this dip will disappear. Yeah, the dip becomes small. So this dip occurs at a frequency of order 1 over n. So this solution actually only holds down to omega of order 1 over n. Now the single particle spacing here is e to the minus n. And so there's some additional new physics between the scales 1 over n and e to the minus n, which Alex Kamenov has a recent paper on. And I know Steve Schenker and many others are studying that in great detail. And some of Alex's results, in fact, and they have numerics where even this dip agrees with their analytic calculations. So but that dip appears at a frequency of order 1 over n. But it's still universal because you still have, you know, lots and lots of states there, because the energy level spacing is e to the minus n. So this is related to the property I was going to mention later. So this state has a non-zero limit of its entropy as temperature goes to zero, which what that means is not that you have any degeneracies. What that means is that the energy level spacing of the states is e to the minus n down all the way down to the ground state. Well, when n is finite, it's not degenerate. It's not like, there's no space, you know, it's not like a topological degeneracy where you have four states which are e to the minus n.
It's not protected.
And then
like,
huh?
It's not like a topological degeneracy because it's not protected.
This may be protected in some way, yes. We don't know, but I think there's a sense in which this is protected.
I would love to know what that means.
Okay, I would too.
It's the same. But that's a low hole. Because you see
explicitly
that the gap is only 1 over n.
No, the gap is e to the minus n.
Yeah, that gap is only 1 over n.
I mean, but there's just a whole continuous spectrum. It is not as if you can say this is the protected space and these are not the protected space. Yeah, so basically the ground state behaves like any state in the middle of the spectrum. It has volume law entanglement and what was the other thing? Well, and there's a finite ground state entropy. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is probably stupid, but so in QED, if I remember correctly, the self energy in the photon propagator also has a square root above the threshold for electron positron production. So it may be that this
No, no, that's a threshold. That's not a ground state finite.
But could it be that your square root is a sign that maybe your C's can be rewritten as composite operators with two weakly coupled fields?
If you could succeed, I would. Then this would not be a Fermi liquid. I don't think that's possible. Yeah, I mean, the assumption here is that no such thing is possible, and it seems as if that's true. All right, so this slide I liked very much, which is written by Douglas Stanford in a strings meeting that I just saw online. So here, Douglas is comparing, you know, different models of holography. So the most famous one is, of course, the Super-Yang-Mills theory in the large N limit. And it has a dual in one extra dimension, or the bulk, which is basically Einstein gravity plus a few other fields. Okay, and so it's weakly coupled gravity. The anomalous dimensions are large, meaning if you looked at the naive scaling dimensions of various operators here and tried to compute them holographically, at least some of them are even as order of order n. Is that a correct statement, John? The anomalous dimensions of order n in Super-Yang-Mills? Or not quite sure what you mean by large. Is it of order n or? Okay. Okay, all right. And then this is a statement of chaos, which is related to this four-point correlation function I briefly mentioned but didn't write down. It's maximal. So here the origin of this, as best as I understand, is it even goes back to some work of Etuft, who had something called a shock wave near a black hole, where you have this past horizon and a future horizon. Things I could not understand at all what that meant. But there was some shockwave that I think Schenker and Stanford tried to interpret what that shockwave would imply for an actual correlation function in a real quantum system. And they very beautifully showed that it led to this out of time order correlation function. And once you have this out of time order correlation function, you're sensitive to these shockwaves, which, and from the out of time order correlation function, it's clear what that's telling you is very rapid chaotic behavior. And so Einstein gravity saturates this bound of Maldacena, Schenker, and Stanford. So this is all very beautiful, all these results, but the main weakness of this theory is that it's not solvable, at least on the quantum, on this side, in the large N limit. You just simply get Einstein gravity, and Einstein gravity predicts Hawking radiation. And my understanding is then what many people are interested in are the subtle non-thermal correlations in Hawking radiation. And this is completely absent in this way of doing things. No one knows how to get that from gravity. So there's another Vasiliev dual, which is the O.N. Wilson-Fisher fixed point. The bulk dual is some very complicated theory in ADS4 that my colleague Xi Yin is one of the few who can even write down the action. But anyway, but this is a theory we understand well at some level because we can just solve it by more pedestrian methods in the usual 1/n expansion. And all anomalous dimensions are small. And, so we looked at various transport equations and thermalization properties in ON. And in that case, the times for this thing to equilibrate is not of order kT over h, or h bar over kT. It's n times, n divided by n times h bar over kT. So it's a very long time, if it goes to infinity. And of course, it's solvable on the field. This is the easiest thing to solve in the 1/n expansion. And so I added this extra column. So since this thing is not chaotic and doesn't thermalize, at least as n becomes very large, at the n equals infinity level, we don't expect And no one's ever found any black hole solutions. There are no, can't be any black holes, otherwise it would thermalize. You have to really resum the 1 over n expansion to get the black hole solution, and that's a hopeless task. So they don't really exist in this theory, I think. So finally, in some sense, the SYK is somewhere the geometric mean of these. It has anomalous dimensions of order 1. This is this square root that we found is you know, 1/2 or 1/4. Yeah, so 1/4 of the fermion scaling dimension, whereas the bare dimension is, well, 0 or, yeah, 0. So it's about a 1. Chaos is maximal. This is what Kateyev claimed, and Maldacena and Schenker showed in beautiful detail. It saturates this bound. And it's also solvable in the sense that you can put it on a computer anyway or, and really study it. So it's kind of this unique theory, which is both has black holes and is solvable beyond just thermal states. You can also look at, in principle, I think many people are starting to look now at non-thermal correlations and various other things.
Which,
yes?
You're defining having a black hole as the same as being a non-thermal?
No. I'm defining having a black hole as something that thermalizes. Yeah, quickly. Right. Yeah, sure. Why not?
Did anyone compute the out-of-time order correlator directly in n equals 4 super n nodes?
I don't know of any. I think that would be very, I would probably be impossible.
Okay, so the maximal chaos, you mean just from the gravity?
That's right, yeah, from the gravity side. I suspect it'd be, yeah.
Not at weak couplings, right?
Sorry, what?
Only at large couplings.
Right, so there is a calculation by Douglas Stanford at weak coupling in 5/4 field theory,
right,
where he gets, again, kT over h bar is the rate, but a parametric enhancement in front of it. And I suspect that will also happen at super Young Mills at weak coupling. Yeah. Okay, I'm spending way too much time on this. There's no way I'm going to get to the other parts of my talk. So let me just quickly then just summarize the reasons for this last row here. So I already showed you this solution. And then at finite temperature, the next step was this observation by Georges and Parcollet, which was a complete surprise to me, that at finite temperature, the Green's function looked like this, which is exactly the form you expect in a theory with conformal invariance, or in at least at the boundary of a 1 plus 1 dimensional conformal field theory. Okay, and then we realized that what I said earlier, that the entropy as temperature goes to 0 goes to a non-zero, and we computed the exact value of S naught. So that's now been numerically tested, and it agrees beautifully with our result. So this stood there for a while, and this got me depressed. I said, there's no real system that has entropy, so let's forget about this model. I mean, actually, George and Parcollet were less depressed than me, I think. They wrote a few papers even comparing this to cuprates, and it was pretty reasonable. Anyway, I like those papers, but anyway. Then I learned about holography from John and Hong, and in this paper, I noticed that these three properties of this model completely coincided with the properties that John and Hong had determined from the near horizon geometry of ADS2, the entropy, the conformal form of the Green's function with this form, and so on. So I speculated that, or proposed, I suppose, you can read the abstract of my paper, what I said, yeah, so that this is a realizes the near horizon physics of ADS2 cross R2. Anyway, so that just stood there for a while. I think John wrote a very nice blurb in physics for this, but I don't think nobody reacted to this proposal until one day I was surprised to see this talk by Alexei Kateyev at Santa Barbara, where he was again looking at this model, some cousin of it. And what he pointed out was, and I'm going to describe this shortly, that there is some zero mode in the bosonic sector of this model in the two fermion, the four-point correlation function. And the zero mode is very closely linked to the subtle manner in which symmetries are realized in the low energy limit. In particular, there's a reparameterization invariance, which is spontaneously broken to SL2R. And I'll explain what that means in a minute. Okay, so this opened the floodgates. And I went back and looked at the solution more carefully as a function of charge, and found that even the entropy, how the entropy depended on charge, completely matched precisely with what you expect from very general results in theories of gravity on ADS2, including there's a special relation that was found by Ashok Sen for ADS2 black holes, and exactly that relation can be derived from the SYK model. And Baldassin and Stanford found the next correction. They found a linear specific heat with a coefficient gamma in the entropy at low temperatures. And this was linked, again, precisely to the zero mode. And John assures me that the ADS2 solution also has a linear specific heat of this type, right? I didn't check that myself. I sent you an email once. Yes. I'm sure it does, yes. And of course, this result I've already mentioned from this scalar mode, just in a calculation purely in the SYK model, Pitev and Maldesin and Stanford show that you saturate this bound. That's expected to be much more general. So let me give some indication of where all of this comes from. So you can integrate out the fermions in terms of bilocal fields. We call them G and sigma. There's different ways of doing this. It doesn't much matter. And so this is informally some exact representation after some Hubbard-Stratonovich decouplings of the final average theory, ignoring all the replica indices. If you want to see the replica indices, go to our paper. Okay. So this is just a formal rewriting of the whole theory. Now, one very important feature of the low energy limit, which you could already see back here. So the self-energy goes this way. So the mu cancels this mu, the square root of z. And at low frequency, the square root of z is almost much larger than z. So you can throw this term out, and this cancels out. So you can just throw both of these terms out. Now, at least in the low energy limit, what makes the problem difficult to solve is that you have to keep them to make the system UV finite. Otherwise, you can't solve it. But anyway, if you just want the low energy limit, you can throw these terms out. And then, if you throw those terms out, then this action has a huge symmetry. There's an infinite dimensional symmetry where you can reparameterize time. So just all possible diffeomorphisms of the circle back to the circle are as a symmetry of the action, as you can easily check once you throw the time derivative out. In fact, there's no time anywhere, so you would say you would wonder why do you pick a certain solution with the square root of omega? There's no omega in the action. You just factor out the omega, but the omega comes in very sneakily from the fact that you need to make the theory UV finite. And this is actually a very common feature in all, essentially all theories of non-Fermi liquids that we have. If I have time, I'll show you in a minute. The fact that this term just disappears—that's basically, in other words, of saying there's no quasi-particles, because the bare kinematic term of the Fermi statistics and the Fermi anti-commutation rule that comes from here, this doesn't matter. At least in the low energy limits, but it's needed to make it finite.
Yeah, do you understand why in this theory, somehow, even to define the infrared fixed point,
yeah,
somehow you need physics, but not in the standard. Yeah, what's the precise difference from the standard case?
I can't say I really understand that very well. I mean, what's different here is that, in the standard case, so, you have some k squared becomes k to the 2 minus eta or something. You can't just throw the k squared out in solving for the 2 minus eta. You take the k squared and you normalize it somehow, and eventually it becomes some anomalous dimension. Here, there's a...
There's no space.
Well, if you throw this out, then time basically just becomes a label, and nothing should depend on time, you would say, the solution. But then it's a meaningless solution. You want a solution that in the UV does have this fermion anti-commutation relation.
So I wonder whether this is intrinsic to all the quantum mechanics. kind of Higgs point, or it's actually special for this model?
Well, I would say the fact that this term is irrelevant is not special. But the fact that the irrelevance of this term has all these huge consequences is probably pretty special. here, because there is no space. This is something I want to study more, in fact, and I was going to mention it later.
Thinking happens, right? There's no recapping limit of ADS2. Yeah. And you also always need a UV to put boundary conditions, and you can put something in ADS2.
Yeah, but that's for ADS2, right? His question is more generally in ADS2.
The answer is in the John Gale, there's nothing really, there's no state. So you cannot put anything in ADS2. It's not big enough for the flux to open up.
Yeah, but the question, what is the intrinsic physics for that? Because from the gravity point of view, we understand that point. But from the field theory point of view, what's intrinsically special about this kind of fixed point?
But I think it's the same that there are no states, otherwise.
Okay, right? Let's defer this question towards the, I want to say something about something other than SYK. Well, it looks like I'm not going to be able to, but anyway, so you have this huge symmetry of the action, but the saddle point solution that we found was 1 over square root of time, which is written here. And this is clearly not reparametrization invariance. But what Kateyev emphasized, that this thing is still has this SL2R symmetry. So if you just, just transform times this way, you'll find that this thing goes back to itself for any SL2R transformation of this type. So in the low energy limit, it seems as if there's this reparametrization symmetry where just the requirement that you have a finite UV finite solution, which is sensible and obeys the right, has positive spectral weight, and all of these things that you require any reasonable solution to satisfy, means that the reparametrization invariance has to break down to SL2R. So that's provided you ignore this term, which you can't really. So what Maldacena and Stanford then showed, argued, and this is what you should do. And now if you found the saddle point of this action, now we're going to do fluctuations, Gaussian fluctuation about the saddle point. And when you do that, you get a very complicated spectrum of operators. They've pretty much worked out all of them. But the most important is a certain eigenmode, which is associated with a sort of like a Goldstone mode of this broken symmetry. So what you do is you take your saddle point solution and you do the reparametrization in time. So you just pick any function f of tau, and then you define your Green's function. You're moving along, if you wish, in the Mexican hat. If you were doing the Goldstone mode for the Mexican hat, you would move only along the Mexican hat. So this is the parametrization that will move you along the ridge of the Mexican hat, where f of tau at this point is anything. So this is depends on two times, but this only depends on one function. So it's still a small subspace of the huge space of fluctuations. And now what you notice, now you want to write g of tau this way, and then you put this back into the action and expand that in powers of f of tau. What does the action look like in terms of f of tau? So that's a very complicated job that nobody can do exactly. But they have this very beautiful argument saying that, first of all, when you put this back in the action, when f of tau equals this, the action should be stationary because g doesn't change. So you haven't changed anything if f of tau is SL2R. So it has to only change for things that are not SL2R. That's one point. The second point is that if you expand about, the f of tau equals tau, which is just the basic saddle point solution. For small variations around f of tau equals tau, the thing should be analytic. It should be expandable in integer powers of variations. And that's because all the variations have to come from this term. You have to put it back in. If this term wasn't there, there's no variation. It'd be an exact zero mode. But so that's, I think, quite an innovative argument I haven't seen before in this matter, really. Because here you have a gapless system with all kinds of critical modes. Nevertheless, the expansion of this mode is analytic in time. Normally, it wouldn't be. You'd have some long-range interaction otherwise. So then, from that type of argument, they came up with this proposal with this Schwarzschild. And then many other people, starting from gravity and ADS2, along the lines Diego mentioned, have also derived the same action purely from gravity. And here, the same constant gamma appears. So the gamma has a, is the specific heat, it's the short chain action, and it's precisely because of this action that they show that you saturate this bomb. Okay. It's just a summary of some very beautiful papers by Marlesina Stanford and others. Okay, that's how much I understand of what's going on. All right. So any more questions on SYK? That's one third of where I wanted to get. All right, so now let me talk about a more realistic model for a quantum critical point, for a non-Fermi liquid in two dimensions, which has been studied a lot, and at least in one limit of which we're pretty confident we've got the full solution. And this also has some connections to experiments. So here we start with, this will be a system without disorder. So momentum will be conserved, at least in the scaling limit. So you start with the Fermi liquid with occupied states and empty states. And then you imagine there's a spontaneous broken symmetry where some auto parameter turns on and the Fermi surface, instead of looking square-like, becomes rectangular-like. And there's two choices to orient the rectangle on the x or y direction. And so there's an Ising auto parameter as a function of some parameter lambda. OK, so at finite temperature, you can imagine this kind of phase diagram where there's a whole regime where in two dimensions where the Ising symmetry is broken and where it's not. And if you cross this finite temperature line, then since that's just the Onsager solution of the 2D Ising model will give you the universal properties because it's just a classical finite temperature phase transition. On the other hand, what we're interested in is not this line, but this point. And that point is in a realization of a non-Fermi liquid, which presumably controls a strange metal type physics at finite temperature. So what is the theory of this non-Fermi liquid? So this is kind of what it looks like in the low energy limit. So you start with the Fermi surface, and then you have some order parameter, we're calling it phi, which has some long wavelength fluctuations. So imagine it has some long wavelength fluctuation at the wave vector q, where q is very small. Now this is going to scatter the fermions. The fermions will just see this as some potential, which they're going to scatter off. And so in the first order in perturbation theory, the fermions will just pick up momentum q from a fluctuation momentum q. Now, normally, if you just take a fermion out down here, it cannot pick up momentum q because of the exclusion principle. If you pick a fermion here, it picks up momentum q, it goes from here to there, and the energy changes a fair amount linearly in q. But there's two special Fermi points, this point and that point, where if the fermion picks up momentum q, its energy changes quadratically in q, q squared, which is much smaller. So that's the resonant point where you have a near degeneracy of scattering. And so one can argue that you just want to focus on these two points. OK, so if you focus on these two points and expand in kx and ky about these two points in momentum space, this is the kind of theory you get. And this is starting to look like Gross-Nouveau type models where you have fermions coupled to a scalar field with a Yukawa coupling. But there are, of course, important differences. This is not a direct dispersion. It's a dispersion which is linear in this direction and quadratic in that direction. But most importantly, what it has is not a point zero, but a line of zeros. So if you want to ask at what momenta is the energy of the fermion zero, for a Dirac or a Weyl fermion, that's just one point in momentum space. But for this case, it's the line. Kx equals ky squared, which is this line, I guess, or something. And these two are chiral fermions. One is traveling the x direction, the other is traveling in the minus x direction. And this kind of theory, I should say, applies to a very large class of systems in condensed matter. If you had gauge fields, abelian or non-abelian, ferromagnetism, all kinds of auto parameters along with it, basically it always reduces it to some variant of this theory. All right, so there's been a huge amount of work starting in the 90s by many, many people that I have not mentioned here. But I just want to mention some very nice recent work by Sung-Sik Lee and collaborators, which I think are the the best and most controlled solutions we have of this problem today. One is this chiral problem, where you throw away the psi minus. Imagine you break time reversal and you only have one side of this Fermi circuit. For that case, we believe the solution, the exponents are known exactly, and that a fixed point exists. And the other is this epsilon equals 5/2 minus d expansion, where also it seems that if, at least to all orders in epsilon, there's a non-Fermi liquid state. Now, if you did this precisely in the physical problem, in two dimensions for this problem, we don't expect a non-Fermi liquid state finally. What we expect is a superconductor. This thing has also a superconducting instability. So you have to do something to suppress that superconducting instability to even make sense of the problem. And both of these things have different tricks of doing that in a systematic way. Okay. Anyway, so I'm running out of time. So let me just make one basic point, and I have to skip the rest. So now you could just try to do naive perturbation theory in G for this kind of theory. So one thing you can do then is, say, compute the self-energy of the boson from the one loop diagram, and you get the famous Landau damping, which dominates all other terms in the bosons, which is why I haven't put any time derivative or even x derivative of the boson field in the action. Then you take this boson and you look at the fermion self-energy, where you take the fully denormalized boson sitting in here, and you compute it, and you get this famous non-Fermi liquid behavior with an omega to the 2/3 singularity. And these solutions that I mentioned by Sung-Sik Lee obey this result exactly to all orders. So at least for some models, this is exact. And that's quite a non-trivial statement. So here, I just want to note that if I wrote this boson in terms of infinite sum of bubbles, these are the graphs that we are summing. And this is almost the same as this graph. Just the first one of these with one bubble is exactly the same as that. So, okay, so this is not that unrelated to the SYK solution. Of course, there's a momentum space floating around here that makes it in many ways harder to work with. All right, so now this omega to 2/3 seems to require some very complicated integrals to evaluate, which, believe me, when I first saw this result in the 90s, I couldn't do those integrals. But now let me give you a very simple argument as to where this comes from. And so what we've seen here is that this self-energy is omega to 2/3. So if I put this back in the action, this d by d tau term is not important, like I just mentioned for SYK. So let's throw the d by d tau term out to begin with, and let's look at the scaling properties of this thing. All right, so just rescale space and time in this way. You'll find the action remains invariant, provided you rescale psi, and you also rescale the coupling. So if you had some fixed point, and then this coupling should be fixed. So that tells you z equals 3/2. So that's the quickest way to see where z equals 3/2 come from. It's just the natural fixed point of this theory. We throw out this d by d tau term. Now, one thing that occurred to me a few weeks ago was, if you throw this term out, that means this also has a reparameterization and time symmetry in the low energy limit. And as far as I know, nobody's explored whether that has any consequences. It probably doesn't, because these things come in to make it not as powerful. You can't throw the other derivatives out, at least when you perturbatively analyze it. But you can see that there certainly is some more than a passing similarity to the SYK solution. Okay. All right. Let me mention. I started 5 minutes late, right? About this time. Okay, so let me just mention some recent work. This is my last slide. So this is old work. You can compute various thermodynamic quantities. You can compute the entropy density, and it goes as T^2. And you can interpret this, if you wish, as in this form. You would say that this is a d-dimensional system with z equals 3/2. But it's effectively one-dimensional, because the only dimension that matters is the dimension transverse to the Fermi surface. So you just introduce this violation of hyperscaling exponent theta, And so the effective dimensionality is 1, and theta is d minus 1, and then you reproduce the result. Interestingly, that kind of naive argument works also for the optical conductivity. So normally the conductivity is omega to the d minus 2 over z. You can say, well, okay, the effective dimensionality is not 2 but 1, so replace d by d minus theta, and then you get the right answer. And this is true to all orders. However, as Avishkar showed, if you do this with the viscosity, it doesn't work. For the viscosity, we actually don't, what we should have expected for the viscosity should be the same as the entropy density, should be d minus theta over z. But it's not. It's d minus theta minus 2 over z. And the reason is that for the viscosity, you intrinsically, you need two spatial dimensions to define it, one along the Fermi surface and one perpendicular to the Fermi surface. And so the fact that it has this very strange scaling in one direction as opposed to the other at each point on the Fermi surface matters. And so you get a result that you wouldn't have naively expected from holographic type arguments or these scaling arguments. And it's really sensitive to the fact that you have this Fermi surface. Anyway, but anyway, it's the right direction. 8 over S is really large. It's not smaller than the bound. Okay, I'm just going to end there. I'm not going to be able to talk about Higgs criticality. Let me just show this picture for the particle theorists. So this is the particle content of our favorite theory, at least a few of us, of the optimal doping critical point in the cuprate. There's an SC2 gauge field and some U1 symmetries, and this is the kind of tables I always see in particle physics papers. So now I'm paying back, giving you what. But it looks, I mean, surprisingly similar to the kind of physics that goes on in the Weinberg-Salam model. With the one important difference is that our quarks are not massless to begin with in Virac, but they have a Fermi surface. And then you get a lot of the physics of the cuprates, which I'll be happy to talk about in private. All right, thank you very much.
Do you have an independent
calculation
of the optical conductivity?
Yes, yes. So the optical conductivity was first computed by Yongbek, Kim, Furusaki, Lee, and Wen. And they used some very different arguments on some quasi-particle picture, which I don't understand, but they got the right answer. Then we used... Well, okay, they got an answer, which is omega to minus 2/3. We did it using the F5½ minus epsilon expansion. And using scaling arguments and various properties of the epsilon expansion, we get the same, exactly, omega to minus 2/3. It's the same answer.
There could have been another epsilon.
There could have been. Right. I mean, the fact that you're looking at a conserved current is important, at least in the way we reason through the thing. Furusaki et al. Seem to be relating it to some quasi-particle picture almost. You know, those are the days of HLR and so on, where everything, even the non-Fermi liquid, was interpreted in a quasi-particle language. I don't particularly like that. What we did was the 5½ minus epsilon expansion. And to all orders in that expansion, it seems pretty clear that you get minus 2/3.
So this conduction critical exponent is zero.
The conduction critical exponent?
Yeah.
For the optical conductivity anyway. Yeah. Well, it's, yeah, so there's various holographic works by Blaze and Sean and others. I couldn't make this fit really to any of those models. Maybe you, Blaze, you have a comment.
This comment about the conserved current. Yeah. We know from holography that somehow this does not necessarily save you. The field theory argument would suggest that if the current is conserved, then there's no room for any anomalous dimension. To
oh, that's what you mean. Yeah, so here it's very much that.
Maybe could also happen.
Right, that's right. So this was in fact the motivation for doing this calculation was we do find that the this theta anomalous the violation of hyperscaling from the just entropy does appear, but there's nothing additional for the current. But even that's too simple a picture. I'm now starting to think because for the viscosity we get another surprise. It doesn't seem to. It's completely different again. Yeah.
Just one comment about the viscosity is that when I was looking at this fusion bounds in holographic theories, it's known in holographic and anisotropic holographic theories that each exile is different to 1/4 particle.
Yes.
But you can reformulate what it is.
Yes.
Look like this fusion bound.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is that there's different velocities now in different directions.
Yes.
So the viscosity also still kind of looks as if there's a time scale 1/T in it.
Right.
So I just think it might be possible to think of this viscosity in the same way because there's this ratio may be affecting the relative velocities.
Yeah, but not just velocities. I mean, the point is it's linear in one direction and quadratic in the other. So you'd have to take a holographic model like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, let's thanks for you again.